This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, I'm going to be talking about The Huntsman, Winter's War, Miles Ahead, Elvis and Nixon, Holidays, and April in the Extraordinary World. There's also going to be some news, the trailer park, some listener feedback, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
One bit of follow-up to a news story that dominated the show last week, and that is the fallout from AMC's CEO Adam Aron saying that he would consider allowing texting in theaters. It was so massive that it prompted him, within days of this interview, sending out a press release and notice via Twitter that they've reconsidered, they heard people complain, and he said that texting in the theaters is going to be allowed, quote, not today, not tomorrow, and not for the foreseeable future. And of course, everyone thought that was great. They're like, oh, good, he finally came to his senses. Isn't that wonderful? We got full commitment from AMC that we're not going to have texting in theaters, which, if you go back to what I said before, I kind of think by default they allow it anyways, because they don't do any sort of supervision. They just put a announcement up, and technically it's against policy, but try and complain about it and see if anyone does anything. But here's the problem. This is not a mistake he should have ever made. The fact that you had the CE freaking O of a theater chain even suggest this shows a massive amount of arrogance and stupidity and a complete misunderstanding of the market that he's in the business of. I mean, it's not the same in terms of a life or death situation, but it would be like if somebody was elected sheriff somewhere and they went to a press conference and they said, you know, we might consider letting people text while they'll drive. We'll have just a separate lane for it. You don't want a sheriff ever to think that would be okay. That is such a terrible idea. And it is so bowing to the whim of the unwashed, knuckle-dragging masses that just insist on having things exactly the way they want to. I mean, every generation is a big whiny baby. My generation was a big whiny baby in the 80s, and the baby boomers were a big whiny baby in the 50s, and the millennials are big whiny babies now. Everyone, when they're teenagers and in their 20s, they think they know everything. And so you get this arrogance of youth, but then it's when you get this idiocy from grown-ups who should know better trying to kowtow to the arrogance of youth is when it's a problem. Trust me, we are going to see this suggestion come up again and again every year or two at CinemaCon, just as Regal CEO Amy Mild suggested it 4 years ago. The fact that this is the second major theatrical chain CEO to think this might be a good idea, send up a balloon and test it, shows that theater bosses don't care at all about the quality of presentation and manners. They're just desperate for butts to be in their seat. And they think that the best way to get that younger audience that's bleeding from their theaters is to pander to them, or at the worst, pander to the lowest common denominator of that group. Now, on the flip side, the internet also makes a great voice for this, and that's where all the rage was shown up, because this guy flip-flopped on the issue so fast. Variety didn't have time to even publish their interview on paper. It was on the internet, and the internet went nuts. And that's great, until somebody just doesn't care about loud voices on the internet, which is going to happen soon. People are starting to get very numb to that. Now, I'm going to do a little bit of listener feedback here, because this prompted a response from a listener, Tim, in Ohio. And he said, with the looming demise of movie theaters, do you think drive-in theaters will see a huge resurgence? I love drive-in theaters as much as everybody does, and I know you do too. I don't know if this is going to have any impact on drive-in theaters. Drive-in theaters are kitsch at this point. They're fun sort of throwback things. They're a cheap way to go see new movies, you can usually get a double feature and you can take the kids and not have to worry about people being talking because you're in a car. I mean, I go to a drive-in theater every now and then, but I don't think we're going to get a resurgence of them because what you get from the drive-in theater, you get at home. I mean, phones and theaters are probably going to drive a little bit of interest in alternative, more selective entertainment where you have a little more control, like places like the Alamo Drafthouse, which specializes in cracking down on texting and talking, or drive-in theaters, which oftentimes give you vintage content, or you might just get double features of two movies that are out and you can just pay for the carload. So, yeah, I mean, I'd love to see drive-in theaters come back more, but honestly, what do you get out of a drive-in theater that you don't get in your home theater, with the exception of just an earlier window of release? I mean, there's one in Central Ohio where I live. There's one within reasonable driving distance, and they do very well. But in the 70s, there were like a dozen, and there's a reason for that. Couple other little pieces of news to talk about. Emil Clarke won't return as Sarah Connor in the new Terminator movies, which is not a big surprise. Nobody cared about her anyways. And the big talk of those was Arnold Schwarzenegger coming back. And while she was fine as Sarah Connor, I think she did a fine job. It really didn't feel like anyone was like, yes, she's iconic Sarah Connor. I mean, you can't have Linda Hamilton come back because she's too old now. I mean, at least to play the young Sarah Connor. But, you know, she's a replaceable actress in this. And then finally, Robert Downey Jr. has said that Sherlock Holmes 3 may start shooting next year, which is cool. I like the Sherlock Holmes movies. I don't know if anyone else is dying for this. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one I want to hit is Jason Bourne. This is the return of Matt Damon as Jason Bourne in the self-titled film directed by Paul Greengrass.
He's seen things. He knows things. What if he's not coming for us? What if it's something else?
I volunteered because of a lie. This is Jason Bourne.
I need to talk.
You're never going to find any peace. Not till you admit to yourself who you really are.
I think maybe the Bourne series has lost a bit of steam. It seems like it's very much a, oh, that was so 10 years ago. It could be good. I mean, I love Paul Greengrass as a director. I think he does great stuff. I'd like to see him do more than just action films with Matt Damon. Because aside from Jason Bourne movies and Green Zone, which was basically a Jason Bourne type movie, the only other thing he's directed in recent memory was Captain Phillips, which was fantastic, but I'd love to see him do something a little bit more. Still, Jason Bourne, probably going to be a good movie. Looking forward to it. The next one I want to talk about is The Birth of a Nation, the huge Sundance hit that opens on October 7th.
Brethren, I pray you sing a new song. Let the high plains of God be on the mouths of the saints and a two-edged sword in their hands to execute vengeance on the demonic nations and punishments on those peoples, to bind their kings with chains. Dishonor have all his saints. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord. Sing to him a new song.
Stand by. Brace yourself. I'm ready to just swerve right into the political incorrectness at this point. It's from Fox Searchlight. It's about slavery. It's coming out in early October. This seems to be them trying to recreate the lightning in the bottle of 12 Years a Slave. I've not seen this movie, and I hear it's good, but I'm wondering if part of the good buzz coming out of Sundance was the reviewers and Hollywood itself saying, oh, goody, we now have a movie so we could not have the Oscar So White campaign hit when the Oscar announcement comes in. It just feels so much like they're just so excited that it's a slavery drama, that it's a reason to be in the Oscars. And we can actually nominate black people this year. Isn't that wonderful, people? Even though you could have nominated Ava DuVernay for Selma a couple years ago. So I don't know. I mean, the trailer seems so heavy-handed. I mean, have we not already seen just the awful, horrible slave owners and the terrible condition? I mean, we've seen it a dozen times. I'm holding out hope that it's a good movie, but I just hope it's just not a retread of everything else we've seen before. I hope there's at least something unique and different to it, and that it's not just a reason for the Academy to breathe a sigh of relief for next year's Oscar ceremony. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Elvis and Nixon and April and the Extraordinary World. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Oh, oh, I love you so. Uh-uh. I can't let you go. Don't tell me no. I need your love tonight.
Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews. Let's talk about Elvis and Nixon. The bizarre meetup between the President of the United States and the King of Rock and Roll is chronicled in this whimsical comedy.
You remember when you talked about finding an ally for Nixon?
Someone from the outside.
I need to get this letter to the president.
You'll never guess in a million years who just showed up at the Northwest Gate asking to see him.
It's Elvis.
Elvis Presley.
So you think we should meet with him?
Yes, Mr. President. Everybody loves Elvis.
Call me.
He could really help us with the youth vote. He would also like a badge.
A what?
I would like to go undercover as a federal agent.
I could infiltrate the communists, and then I'd bust them all.
Let's do this thing.
I find it interesting, the love affair that Hollywood has with telling stories about Richard Nixon. And it seems to be cyclical. It seems to take place every 20 years or so. Because Nixon was the first conservative slash Republican president who you could openly hate in the media. And a lot of the people in Hollywood, and especially the writers, the people who generate the content, tend to fall on the left-hand side of politics. They tend to be Democrats and liberals. So they grew up hating Nixon, and that's just the way things are. Just as conservatives of tomorrow are going to grow up hating Obama, conservatives of 20 years ago grew up hating Clinton, and liberals of Generation X grew up hating Reagan. So it's just whoever the opposing party is in the White House is going to be the focus of your ire. Now, in 1970s, that's when Nixon was happening, and you see him show up in a couple things. Like Alan Moore had him as the lifetime president in Watchmen, which is such an Alan Moore, you know, stick it to the man kind of thing. But in the mid 90s, they had a couple of these movies. They had one called Dick, which starred Michelle Williams and Kirsten Dunst. And they were these two kind of bubble-headed teenagers who meet up with Richard Nixon or something like that. I saw it. I don't remember much about the movie. You, of course, had Oliver Stone's Nixon, which met with accolades, at least from the critical side, and met with a lot of empty seats in the box office because nobody cared to go see a 3.5-hour diatribe about President Nixon. And then there was a movie called When Elvis Met Nixon, which was I think it was an HBO movie. And this tells the same story. Then it kind of disappeared for a while. Yeah, they had Frost Nixon, but that was just sort of a blip on the radar. And suddenly we were getting a Nixon interest again. We've got Kevin Spacey playing Nixon. I misspoke on the radio earlier this week, and I said that Johnny Knoxville played Nixon, which I think would make an amazing movie just because that's out of the box casting. But no, Johnny Knoxville just plays one of the Memphis Mafia. But Kevin Spacey plays Nixon, and Michael Shannon plays Elvis. And it's the true story of Elvis one day just gets up in the early 70s and is like, hey, I got to go talk to the president. And so he somehow manages to get into Nixon's office and talk to him. It's this weird little blip in American history slash popular culture that had no bearing and no impact on anything else. It was the bizarre meeting, completely unplanned, that just sort of emerged. And it's an interesting footnote. Back 20 years ago, when HBO or Showtime did their When Elvis Met Nixon movie, I remember thinking, is there enough content to really stretch that into a full movie? Same thing with this film. I'm like, is there really enough story behind this to really put a 2-hour or an hour and 26-minute story to it? The answer is no. Probably the best part about the movie is the performances. They have some very funny performances of side characters, in particular Colin Hanks as one of the White House staff members who's trying to arrange this meeting. He's actually quite good in it. But obviously the bulk of the story falls on Kevin Spacey, who plays Nixon, and Michael Shannon, who plays Elvis. And they both actually do a pretty good job, because those are two characters that are so hard to perform because it's so easy to slip into caricature. So easy to talk like Elvis like this. Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Anybody can do that. Any idiot who has watched a couple Elvis videos can probably somehow emulate the King's speech. And the same way, the King's speech has nothing to do with the movie. The same way anyone watching old footage of Nixon can kind of do the Nixon stammer and sort of jowl talk. But it's very hard to do that without falling into caricature. And Anthony Hopkins wasn't able to do it. Was it John Cusack who played Nixon in that Butler movie? He was terrible as Nixon. These are roles that are really tough to play. And both Spacey and Shannon do a really good job kind of becoming the characters without falling into caricature. Their performances are actually kind of fun to watch. It's just there's not much there to the story. You know Elvis is a goofball and an idiot and kind of a, you know, somebody who's not quite there. And you know Nixon is annoyed with the situation but kind of taken with it, and it just kind of steamrolls to a certain point. There's just some great character interaction to it, but other than that, it's, you get to the end of the movie, you're kind of like, well, what was the point of that? That's kind of how I felt. It had some chuckles, but I don't know. It's certainly not worth seeing in theater. So I'm going to have to say Elvis and Nixon, while interesting and have some good performances, it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about April and the Extraordinary World. In an alternate history of France, scientists have been working on a super soldier vaccine since the 1800s, and suddenly the world's scientists start to disappear, keeping them in the steam age.
In a world deprived of invention and stuck in the age of steam, the greatest scientific minds are disappearing. Colleen!
This is a French animated film distributed by G-Kids, which distributes a lot of great stuff. If you like to have an alternative to the very high concept, mass marketed stuff that even Pixar does. I mean, I love Pixar's movies, but let's face it, they're going for big box office and very broad appeal. But if you want something that's a little different and a little bit more restrained, check out some of the stuff that G-Kids produces. They've been known to distribute some of the Studio Ghibli stuff, like My Neighbor Totoro and Up on Poppy Hill. They've also done a lot of stuff that's getting nominated for Academy Awards, like The Secret of the Kells and Ernest and Celestine. It's almost always taken from other countries, like, you know, Japan or various places in Europe. It's kind of out of the box. It's very different. This is this weird mix of steampunk and Studio Ghibli, but it has this scientific knowledge versus keeping people not so smart because they can blow things up. It does have a bit of a peacenik message to it, but it's a fascinating film. The main story is it follows this little girl whose parents are whisked away and disappeared. She thinks they're dead, but they're somewhere else, and she's trying to recreate this formula. It's a fascinating looking movie. It's beautiful. It's in French with subtitles, so you're going to have to face that. But it borrows a bit from certain imagery from anime, borrows a bit of imagery from some Ghibli titles like The Cat Returns and Howl's Moving Castle, but it's still wholly unique. It's not steampunk, but it certainly has its toe dipped in that genre. April and the Extraordinary World is definitely worth checking out. So I'm going to have to say April in the Extraordinary World rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Huntsman, Winter's War, and Miles Ahead on Fat Guys at the Movies.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing with the movie reviews. Let's talk about The Huntsman: Winter War. In this prequel and sequel to Snow White and the Huntsman, the Wicked Queen's sister goes all Elsa across the land and creates an army of huntsmen to try and capture the magic mirror a decade later. What?
To escape the pain of her loss, the good queen built a fortress of ice around her heart. If she could not raise a child, she would raise an army.
You will train. You will become my huntsman.
I thought I made you strong.
But you're as pathetic as you ever were, little sister. This is my kingdom.
This is the most confusing blurb of a story I had to write. I actually started writing it and I got into the whole thing where she created the huntsman. Then I'm like, oh, wait, there's a whole story about the magic mirror. The story behind this movie is actually, I find, more interesting than the story in this movie. And that is that when Snow White and the Huntsman came out, what was it, like 4 years ago? Kristen Stewart starred as Snow White. And Chris Hemsworth was the huntsman. It did well enough. It wasn't a massive hit, but it did pretty well. It was a good, solid performing movie. And they're like, we got to make a sequel to this. The only problem is Kristen Stewart had an affair with the director. Kind of destroyed his marriage, put her on the skids with her boyfriend. That she hasn't actually done any big, massive budget thing since. I mean, aside from the Twilight movies. But I think once she got out of the Twilight movie, she's like, okay, I'm done with this. I need to go back to my roots of independent film. And it's been good for her with stuff like Camp X-Ray and the Clouds of Silmaria. I mean, so she's done other things along the way. I mean, the biggest thing she's done since the Twilight franchise has been American Ultra last year. And that was kind of in the middle. So they don't have Snow White in the movie, but there's a lot of Snow White that's talked about. And there's literally a couple shots of her from archive footage. And there's one where they got a body double where she's facing away. And so you got the hair and then she yells, but you can tell it's just sampled from raw footage from the first film that they own the rights to. And they talk about her all the time, but they never show her. So it's like, oh, well, yeah, the queen, Snow White wants this. And it's so obviously written around Kristen Stewart. It's almost shameful. It also is notable because the best role in the first one was Charlize Theron, who, if you recall from the first movie, is killed at the end. So they have to shoehorn Charlize Theron in this with flashbacks and a prequel. I mean, there's like a 30-minute setup to this movie that just goes on and on and on. And so they kind of have Charlize Theron in there, so she's kind of another name and face you can put on the poster. But the worst part about it, I think, in terms of setting this story up, is you've got Emily Blunt playing the Charlize Theron's character sister, who is wronged in a certain way. Don't watch the trailer because it totally tells like the third act spoiler. But she's wronged in a certain way and she turns into this ice queen and she starts shooting ice out of her fingertips and turning everything she is into snow and ice. She goes off into the mountains, builds an ice castle. And I'm watching this thing going, did Disney not at some point call them up and be like, yeah, hey, we did an entire movie that made $1 billion about that. I mean, she doesn't create a snowman that sings. That's like the one thing that differentiates this character. This is essentially Elsa going into wintertime hatred. It feels so derivative. And maybe they came up with it before Frozen hit. I don't know. But it's shoehorned in there. It's not an organic feel. I said to the rep when I left, I said, I didn't like it. She's like, oh, really? I go, well, they certainly threw a lot of money at this. You can tell they said, we need to make the sequel. Write a script, and the script didn't work. And so they said, let's just keep throwing money at it. Keep doing rewrites and keep having people work on the script and change it and do this. And you get this overly convoluted movie. And then they said, let's get actors. Well, Chris Hemsworth, really outside of the Marvel franchises, can't carry a movie by himself. So we'll get Charlize Theron. We'll shoehorn her in there. We'll do Emily Blunt, who also really isn't a name you can put on a poster that's going to make people flock to your movie. There's no Kristen Stewart in this. They put Jessica Chastain in it. And I don't like Jessica Chastain. I think she's one of the most overrated actresses around. And she does this ludicrous Irish accent for some reason in this movie. And then they said, okay, we're going to have some dwarves in here, but we're only going to use two of them. So they bring back Nick Frost, and they have Robert Broughton from The Trip and The Trip to Italy. He shows up as one of the dwarves, and they have, like, love interest dwarves. But it's funny because they say lines in the trailers. They don't show the female dwarves at all. Almost out of, like, well, we can't make this movie look like it's about dwarves. I mean, it looks beautiful. I mean, like I said, they threw a lot of money at this movie. I mean, in terms of special effects and the cast and, you know, the production design. I mean, it's a little derivative, and it doesn't really pop outside of any other fantasy movie that we've seen lately. That's the problem. When Lord of the Rings was first made, that really defined fantasy movies, and we hadn't seen this kind of stuff because the CGI hadn't been good enough at that point. And so we were seeing this for the first time, and now, after almost 20 years of these movies, you know, it's, oh, look, another castle. Oh, well, look, more fairies. We've seen that a dozen times. There's nothing about this movie that's unique. And the story doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's kind of hard to follow. There's no real main character. And it's just a lot of stuff just crammed in there just to work. There, you guys could just see them just like, you never ever like open one of those Pillsbury dough packages for like crescent rolls and stuff. Boom. And imagine trying to get that dough back into the case. And that's them making this movie, but it just keeps pouring out the sides. The Huntsman: Winter's War looks gorgeous, but not a good movie. It sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Miles Ahead. A violent snippet of turmoil in jazz trumpet great Miles Davis' life is shown in this unconventional biopic.
You have new material.
My material. My session tape.
You're under contract here.
We actually own that tape.
Miles!
You own? How much money you got on you? Okay, you about 19,000 light, but that's a start. I moved to New York, met some cats, made some music. Somebody stole my tape.
What?
You call him right now, tell him you're coming over.
Can't take y'all over there, man. He'll kill me.
You don't do what I say, I'm gonna kill you.
Let me start by saying I'm not a big fan of jazz. I've never listened to much jazz. It's just not a thing. Jazz is the kind of thing. And I know there's even a part in the trailer that's in the movie where Miles Davis takes issue with it being called jazz, but I'm calling it jazz. But jazz is the kind of music that it becomes a part of you when you first hear it and you love it. And you can learn to appreciate it. I'm paraphrasing Pretty Woman, by the way. You can learn to appreciate jazz, but never going to be a part of you. It's never going to be part of your soul. Jazz has never really been part of my soul. And I admit that. So I mean, I can appreciate how good of a trumpeter Miles Davis was, and I can appreciate how good of a musician he was, but I'm never really going to feel it in my soul. But I know that if you love Miles Davis, I know if you like his stuff, and if you're really into jazz and his music and his social music, then you'll probably love this movie because it really shows an insight into him and how he thought. It's directed by Don Cheadle, who also plays Davis in the movie. And like the music itself that Miles Davis has done, which involves a lot of improvisation and non-traditional usage and being different and adding personality. One thing I respected like crazy about this movie was how Cheadle said, we're not just going to do a typical biopic. Most biopics, you like take something like Ray or Walk the Line, or even more recently, I Saw the Light. It starts off when they're either a kid or a younger man, and they're not doing very well, and they're struggling, and then they do well, and maybe get fame, and then they run into booze and drugs and women, and then they have a downfall and maybe a resurgence. All musician stories follow the same arc, and all of them have the same problems. And so biopics for musicians in particular can get kind of tedious. This one's different. It flashes back into those bits, but overall, it's a very unique way of approaching a look at somebody's life. And that's probably the best part. It's a jazz version of a movie. And in that respect, I think Don Cheadle did a great job directing. And in the same way, there's so much subtlety there that not everyone's going to get it. It's going to be forgotten by award season. I mean, my God, it's April. No one's going to remember this movie come December. So, yeah, I mean, I give him a lot of credit for making this movie. It tells this little story of him trying to track down these master tapes that no one really has a full account of what happened here. So there's a lot of liberties taken. But it works for what it is. And I respected it. I wouldn't say I particularly enjoyed it because I'm just not into the music. But if you're into that music, you're absolutely going to love it. So I'm going to say Miles Ahead kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to review Holidays, give a quick Fat Guy 5, do the box office, and talk about the home cinema roundup. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare necessities or Mother Nature's recipe.
Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, showing greatness in movie reviews and taking over the world with awesome commentary. Let's continue that commentary along with Holidays. This is a smaller, independent horror film. It's an anthology of holiday-themed stories that give a grisly look at Valentine's Day, Easter, Christmas, and of course, Halloween and beyond.
I'm sorry, we're closed.
Oh, no. I called about the...
Sorry, pal.
I'm scared.
Shh. Time to close your eyes and go to sleep.
Someone's coming tonight.
Happy Valentine's Day.
It's Christmas Eve. I'm out of time.
Daddy? Stop smiling!
Not a whole lot of story to be given in that trailer because there's like 7 different stories to it. It's a neat idea. I've always enjoyed anthology movies, mainly because it's sort of like reading a book of short stories. I always thought this when I was younger. What's great about a book of short stories, if you're in one that's not very good, it'll be over with soon and you're going to have another one, as opposed to when you're reading a book and you're just like, well, I'll stick with it. Before you know it, you spent 200 to 250 pages into this book. You still got 200 more to go and you're like, oh, why am I? I should just stop. The only problem is that when you have a movie or a book of short stories, that one's not very good. You wait to the next one, then that's not good. Then you get to the next one. That one's not good. But there are a couple little gems in here. The one about Father's Day is actually... I wouldn't say it's the greatest story, but it's different and it's kind of cool and it's creepy. It definitely works. That I think was probably my favorite. There are a couple that are very ambitious. The one about Christmas is extremely ambitious. Doesn't quite stick the landing on some of its ideas. The one for Easter is also a really kind of neat idea and a nice little pairing with Krampus, which comes out next week on Blu-ray and DVD. But the Easter version of horror, it's interesting. I see where they were going with it, but there's just something imperfect about it. The Valentine's Day segment is somewhat straightforward. There's one for St. Patrick's Day, which is actually kind of clever. It gets a little off at the end, but it still is a neat idea and a neat story. So I would say probably my favorite ones are the ones about St. Patrick's Day and in specific Father's Day. And then there's some of them that kind of fall into cliche. The New Year's Eve one is a bit cliche, sort of going all the way back to like EC horror comics cliches. There are a lot of anthology movies that are coming around, which is great because I love anthology movies. And there have been really cool ones like The ABCs of Death and VHS and like Tales of Halloween from last year. Those are some neat ideas. And I always applaud independent companies for doing that. This one isn't as great of an assortment of stories as we've seen in the past. There's one that's the Halloween one, and it's directed by the most famous and most name recognizable director, and that's Kevin Smith. And this short film, I think, encompasses everything that is wrong with Kevin Smith's career right now. First of all, it stars his daughter. And it seems to me right now, at his stage in his career, he's doing the Will Smith thing with After Earth, where he's saying, okay, I'm just going to do all my films are going to rely on giving my daughter acting jobs. And his daughter's not that good of an actress. She's just sort of this average girl. And the only thing that makes her at least workable in this movie is the, well, one of the other girls doesn't have much line, but there's another girl in the scene and she is so terrible that it's almost embarrassing. She talks like a baby. And she's like, I looked it up. She's originally from like Australia. And it sounds like she's trying to do an American accent and just failing miserably at it. The other problem with the Kevin Smith stuff, which falls in line of the sort of a microcosm of his whole career right now, is they're just crass to be crass. He's still doing jokes about private parts and gas humor, essentially. He's not growing as a director. And anytime he's tried to grow as a director, he's completely cut himself down at the knees. There have been movies where it showed some real potential for growth, like Jersey Girl, even Tusk, which was a great body horror movie until it wasn't. It shows that he can't complete something. I think he gets in his own way. I think he's scared of his own success, and he's scared of doing anything more than just the fat guy smoking pot and doing jokes that are immature and childish. He's one of the most depressing individuals to watch now because his career's just stagnated in a way that he couldn't have planned to stagnate it worse. That's just me railing on Kevin Smith there. He directs like 5 minutes, 10 minutes of this movie. Anyways, Holidays is not great, especially when you consider there's so many more portmanteau horror movies out there. So Holidays kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, inspired by Holidays. I just want to do a real quick Fat Guy 5. In case you want to know, my 5 favorite anthology horror movies that have ever been made. Number 5 would be Tales from the Dark Side. This was originally intended to be Creepshow 3, but rights were falling through and they were having problems. And it has a story by Stephen King. It has a story by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It's a great little horror anthology. In next place is Asylum. I had to put an Amicus movie in there because as a whole, I love the Amicus films. The Amicus films are these movies that were these anthology horror movies back from the 60s and the 70s. Obviously, the most well-known one are like Tales from the Crypt and The Vault of Horror, which were done in the early 70s. While I love those movies, still Asylum is my favorite because it's these sort of individual stories that take place in this lunatic asylum. The next one up the list is Trick or Treat. That is Michael Dougherty's anthology horror film, which by one director and by one writer, which makes it a little different compared to some of the other ones. A great Halloween movie. It still holds up. It's one that's going to live as one of the better Halloween movies you're going to see ever, really. The next one is The Twilight Zone, the movie back from, I think, 1984, if I'm not mistaken. That, of course, had John Landis, where John Landis was put on trial for the death of Vic Morrow after that movie. But it also had Steven Spielberg working on it and Joe Dante and George Miller. George Miller did the Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. Great updates of the classic Twilight Zone stories from the TV show. And then my favorite horror anthology movie is, of course, Creepshow, the best one out there. Still, to me, the quintessential top one because it combines my love of horror movies and comic books and anthologies and kind of rolls them all together with George Romero and Stephen King working together. It's a fantastic film. I love it. And I've loved it ever since I convinced my mom to take me to see it when I was like only 10. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's quickly talk about the box office. Was I correct with the box office? Last week I said The Jungle Book was going to make $75 million. I was off. It made money, but it made way more than $75 million. It made over $100 million. The Jungle Book topped the box office with $103 million. And that is fantastic. That's a huge number. It's way above expectations. Disney's probably very pleased with this. Barbershop, the next cut, came in a lot lower than people were expecting. It was just over $20 million. And then Criminal really bombed with just under $6 million at number 6. And I think mainly because it really got raked over the coals from the critics. And I think part of it is the critics just didn't like to root for the bad guy in this sense. Give them a bad guy like Deadpool and they can root for him. But a guy like this, I don't know. Oh, and just for a little bit of note, Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice made $9 million. It was ending the weekend with $311 million, so it's chugging along. It'll probably end up close to $350 when all said and done. And from a global perspective, it's going to at least top, I would imagine it's going to get at least close to, if not surpass, $900 million. This week, I think we're looking at The Jungle Book repeating, and I'm going to say $60 million just to give it a safe number. That's a little less than a 50% drop. And then The Huntsman, I think, isn't going to do terribly well, getting creamed in the reviews, and I really don't sense any real excitement about it. I'm going to give it a very conservative $25 million. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Let's just quickly roll through these films. We've got The Revenant, one of the big movies from 2015, really. Even though it came out for most people in 2016, you can now get it on DVD and Blu-ray. There's Ip Man 3, which is a kung fu movie starring Donnie Yen. We talked about that a couple months ago. Norm of the North, which I didn't get to see, but that's that Rob Schneider as a polar bear fighting real estate developers in the Arctic. And then The Lady in the Van, that stars Maggie Smith as a homeless woman who has a secret past. It's actually a very charming movie, something you can watch with your mom. And then finally, 50 Shades of Black, which is a terrible movie. Don't go see this. Don't rent it. Don't buy it. But I'm only mentioning it because it actually does come out on DVD this week. That's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Keanu, Mother's Day, and Ratchet and Clank. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.